You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Good to see you all. I'm James Acaster, and if you don't enjoy this next half hour, you're in for a long night. Basically, I have to watch it, think it's shit, and then listen to me for an hour talk about my method. How'd you write that joke everyone hated? Interesting story.
Hello there. Welcome back and happy new year. I've got a few archival episodes that I'm going to re-release throughout January. This one is from February 2013, if you can imagine as far back as then, before James Acaster was the comedy titan he is, when he was simply Sweet Little James. And in this episode from many, many years ago, my God, 10 years ago, that's astonishing. This was a new format I was trying at the time, where I booked James to do sort of 20 minutes or half an hour of stand-up, and then we had an intro. I think it was Richard Sandling on the bill as well. I think he may have been. And so I hosted, and then James did a set, and then we had a break, and then we did a live ComCom. It was a fun thing, but very few people were as visionary as James, and very few other acts that I asked were up for that format, because why would you put yourself through that? But we are going to talk about the importance of comedy grounded in truth. We're going to talk about the responsibility to one's audience. We're going to find out what annoys Sweet Little James about comedy, and we also cover purposely sabotaging his own gigs that were going badly. Which I think became a theme for James for some time, which I believe is now happily resolved. And then we have 3 audience questions about wearing slacks. So what we're going to do throughout January, myself and producer Nathan, is release some archival episodes. I'm calling it ComCompendium, so that it sticks out a little bit on your feed. And I am doing this in order to buy myself some time while I get my ducks in a row regarding the ComCom book, the social media rollout of my new special, about which I'll tell you a little bit more in the middle, and also a new keynote that I'm writing about eco-anxiety, and a new show that I'm writing, which isn't about anything. You don't need to know. All right? Speaking of it, here's James Acaster from 10 years ago.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for coming and being brilliant.
Thank you for having me, Stu.
Well done. Well done. Loved the gig. I feel like I should start by going, how was it for you? But there's always a danger you might go, a bit dry. But
hated them, bunch of
Yeah. We're seeing a different side of James now, aren't we? How good would that
be? If
the mask slipped, that would be wonderful. Yeah.
I've just realised that the mask slipped. I've broken my chair. So I'll sit. Oh, no, I can't do that because I've ripped my trousers. Right. Good. I'll just hover over here. You've got to have a thing, haven't you? I've done literally no preparation. But do you know what? Part of me is thinking ahead, going, that's all right, I'll edit that bit out. But not for you, I can't. So that's not
it's
ideal.
Clearly what it's normally like. You listen to a polished versions at home, it's actually him sitting there with Dr. Brown going, no idea what I've got to say anymore.
Yeah. It really is. Rob Rouse went out yesterday, and there's a good 10 minutes of that I cut out because my belly kept gurgling, and with the two of us were just laughing. And then I tried to throw a midget gem into my mouth and missed. So
a fascinating glimpse behind the curtain here for those of you who came to the live show. This bit probably won't make it, so that's special just for you. Mm. Now, let's fucking get on with this. So, how was that for you? That was all new stuff, you were saying.
Yeah, it's good fun. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Because you're on tour at the moment, so how's your tour going?
Yeah, tour's nice. Nicer than last year. But last year I toured the show in May, and I'd already got sick of the show.
Okay.
So I already didn't like the show at all.
Because you've been doing it for a whole Edinburgh...
Well, it was my debut show, so I've been building it up for years, gone to Edinburgh, done it every night in Edinburgh, and then not done it for ages, started to write a new show, which I was more excited about, then had to go out on tour and talk about a fucking cheese grater again. Yeah. I was like, I can't be bothered with this. I just wasn't as excited about... the show anymore. I felt like the show I was writing was better, and I was more excited about it, and I just didn't want to be turning up. You know, plus the numbers weren't amazing. So I was turned up to a small crowd doing stuff that I didn't like anymore. I mean, and it was just not a good Reading.
You did a good job of selling the stuff as if you were still excited about it?
I tried to. I hope I did a good job of it. I tried to, be like, that. I'm still into this. I still like this. But it's hard when you know, because by that point, like, a lot of the routines in the first show are quite short compared to the stuff in the second show, which at that point was already, I was getting more out of subjects and drawing it out. I was more proud of that. And then in my head, I'd really feel it when I just got to the end of a joke really quickly and then moved on. And I just felt like, I think if you know as a performer, this doesn't suit you anymore, and this isn't really who you are anymore, and you're uncomfortable in it, they can tell as an audience that, like, this isn't really him. Whereas, like, because you always have good gigs when you're an open spot, and that's not, you're never the finished article, but, like, you still have good gigs because you're doing the best you can at that point, and the audience can tell when you're doing your absolute best. Mm-hmm. And then if you're being lazy, they can tell as well. And so I felt that going out and doing that show after I'd already moved past it, they could kind of pick up on the fact that this is not, he's not doing his best here.
Sure.
And some nights were quite hard.
That's quite a big element of your work on stage. It's a big element of your act, is that listening to an audience and them knowing where you are and where to place you. So, I mean, you're not a hype guy. You don't come out and go, bang, here's the gear. Your first thing really is to come on and listen and smile and kind of draw us in. Mm. So that, and that's something that's become more apparent in your work since that first tour. So when you did the first tour, it wasn't just a case of I'm tired of the stuff. You'd actually become a different type of performer.
Yeah, going on and kind of just looking at them and smiling, it's all very well and good if you know that you've got material that suits that.
Sure.
Whereas I was going on and, like, still almost trying to be that comic, and then opening with a joke that was a lot more kind of punchy or whatever, and it was just like, oh, hold on, we thought you were going to be this, and you're not. You thought you were going to be quite a slow comic, and suddenly these routines are quite quick, and it's all quite jarring. And whereas with this one now, touring it now, I feel like I am... it's still relevant to me on that comic, and so I can go out and enjoy it for an hour, and I don't feel like they're there going, oh, what do you think? Because the new stuff at the minute is not... up to that, it's not as good. What I did for you tonight, it's not as good as the stuff I'm doing in the show.
But this is the sort of stuff that these people will come and see in the show next year, and they'll go, "Wow, he got another 15 minutes out of the mariachi band."
Yeah, he said da 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 for ages.
That's it. I was saying to James at the interval, we need to walk a fine line here between referring to the stuff you've just seen and not alienating 99% of the people who are going to listen to it. So if for the benefit of the listener, if you don't recognise the da-da-da-da-da bit, then buy a fucking ticket next time and turn up. So, oh, that bit was good, wasn't it? Good, that bit. Oh, marvellous. So in terms of your... there's one of the things I think that's most immediately apparent about your act is the pace of it. You're one of the slowest talkers I can imagine. I think that's fair to say on the circuit.
Yes.
Yeah. And you seem to work a lot with silence and with expectation. Do you think... I did that...
I didn't know if you were being quiet then, if that was a pause before.
I was genuinely listening, but...
Yeah. And is that something that's come about more recently? You said you started off with shorter jokes. Were you... with the shorter jokes, was that... Is this something you've discovered, is what I'm getting at?
No, it's kind of gone in like, cycles. When I started out, I started out doing long stories, and a lot of them would, like, you know, because I wasn't very good at writing and stuff like that, a lot of them would have... I'd be really patient and trust the punchline for the story. So I was used to kind of telling the story for almost 2 or 3 minutes to silence and then getting a laugh at the end. So just like holding my nerve for the whole thing.
That's,
and then,
yeah.
And getting a laugh. Of course, like, you know, it's been my first couple of years, that would often backfire horrifically. But like, you know, I would.
But you stuck with it though, that's the thing. And it is a case of holding your nerve, I think. You do seem, because of the quietness and the stillness, you just exude confidence. And I mean, is that a true reflection of how you're feeling in it? I mean, is there any part of your brain now, say earlier tonight, or during a quiet bit, is there part of you thinking, come on, fuckers, laugh at this?
Well, there are some bits that, like, I know... Once I know the routine, I am confident with it, and it's fine. And then you do relish the silences more, and like, you know, like that. Referring to material is a bit like
to it, refer
that
to
ice cream van did bit that I did at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I know that the build up to it, the first few lines, aren't that funny, and they're very small laughs. If anything, most nights it won't really get anything. But it sounds like they're meant to be funny, and so a lot of the time the audience are thinking, his first joke has already not worked.
Sure.
And this has not gone well already. But I know that the line, when I say I'm in a van, will always be quite a big laugh. And it's that relief of them all going, oh, okay, we can trust him now for the rest of it. And so there's that. And I'm confident with that because I've done it enough times. But the first time I did it, I didn't know where the laughs were or which bit. I didn't know that was the first laugh. I actually optimistically thought that it came a lot earlier. And I didn't know. It wasn't a deliberate thing of like, I'm going to get them with loads of little... They're going to think I'm rubbish and then I'm going to flip it. Yeah. Just genuinely, they thought I was rubbish and then quite luckily there was a line that worked. But like, so when I first did it, I was definitely in my head thinking, oh no, they don't think me offering free refills is a very funny idea at all. And then it turned out that was the joke. And then it's like, okay, fine. But like, you know, there's like a thing tonight, when I was talking about Yoko Ono tonight, that's really new, and I'm only starting to find where the laughs are. So I was definitely with that while I was saying, it's like, see if any of this, and just talk until you get a big enough laugh and then bail and go on to something else.
Yeah, okay.
So like, there was like, you know, I think that something about Jane Asher got a laugh. And then I was like, right, next bit, and then you move on.
Sure.
But
Actually, I made a note there, the split up the Beatles, this bit is a bit coolly received. I just thought, and it was just just interesting from the point of view.
Didn't mention this when you rang me up.
But what I mean is, you can see the first 15 minutes or so, everyone was absolutely with you. And, you know, it's interesting to hear you say, and I don't know, I kind of want to ask the audience, did you find that the Beatles bit was a bit harder going? Did you have less faith in it? I'm not talking about the material itself. I'm talking about the specific performance tonight, seeing as we have the opportunity to kind of to feedback on that.
Oh, go for it. Don't worry about my feelings.
I would mention it if I didn't have absolute confidence in your confidence.
I'm fine.
In the bit.
I know that bit is... very sketchy at the moment.
Sure.
All I know with that bit is that I want to talk about Yoko Ono. And... that I want to defend Yoko Ono for no real reason.
Okay.
During the show.
Okay.
And I know that I think that's funny, but at the moment I don't know how. I don't know like exactly what the words are going to be and the angle on it.
Sure.
But I think there's something funny about Yoko Ono, and so like that's it. So at the minute, it's just saying it on stage a few times and running with it until you find things that point to that, you know, that path might be funny and that path might be funny. And then going away and then writing it and properly like having a day of going, okay, so, you know, saying that Jane Asher wasted her opportunity when she could have done it, and now no one cares who she is. Yeah. So maybe write a thing about that, and then try and find a few angles on it, as many as I can.
Okay.
And do all that. But
and are you finding those angles on stage conversationally?
You're doing it like a bit off and on stage. So you're doing it on stage when you kind of like some ideas like this one. You kind of sit down at home and you don't know. It's something that you almost find so personally funny that you can write down anything at home and go, oh, that's so funny. It's like, for some reason, I personally think Yoko Ono's hilarious.
Sure.
But like, and that's it. But like, you go on stage and you start talking about Yoko Ono and like, you know, it's not a room full of, you know, people like you. It's a right mixture of people. And, like, you know, they've got to all be told why Yoko Ono is funny.
For the benefit of the listener, every person in this room is identical.
Yeah. And, but no, not a jumper and shirt in sight. Yeah. Yeah, so you kind of like so it's like a bit of both. Like with this one, it's like I know it's funny, but I don't actually know why it's funny.
Yeah.
So I'm going on stage just talking about
it. Well, let's talk about that instinct then, that you know it's funny, but you don't know why it is. Because I was thinking in your selection of topics, almost the topics, the subject material you were talking about. You were talking about mariachi bands and Yoko Ono and the ice cream van, you know, that offer. They seem, in retrospect maybe, they seem very James Acaster topics. You know, they're kind of whimsical, but they're also grounded in some kind of mundanity or sort of shared experience. They're not, it's not unicorns and elves, you know, Cochrane is fond of. But it seems kind of gentle and we're like skywriting. Seems like a very Acaster thing. So presumably sometime at some point in the creation of this, I just wanted to talk about that moment when almost like your filter for subject matter kicks in and you go, aha, that's something that could be me. So with the Yoko Ono one, for example, when did that kind of fall into your head? When did you go, there's something about that?
I had the bit about the band on the Titanic and I started writing about music anyway and like forming a band and had the bit about the band in the Titanic being the most committed band because they never split up.
Yeah.
And they saw it right through to the end. And I knew that was funny because it was working on stage, but like I knew it had to go somewhere. So I wanted to compare them to other bands who split up and I was kind of thinking about how other bands split up and what people are familiar with. And then it's like the Beatles split up and everyone blames Yoko Ono. And then with that, it was just an instant thing of like, that's something about Yoko Ono.
Sure.
Is something that I would want to hear about in a show. Like, if a comic went on stage and went, so what about Yoko Ono? I'd be like, I'm on board for an hour.
Yeah, okay.
Like, it would be like, I would instantly, like, I want to hear about
because
this.
Because it seems so outdated, or and you're attracted to it, why?
I think it just... there's something about it that's fun, inherently funny. And also, like... It's not even a thing where I can instantly go, that is exactly why I think that's funny. There's certain things that you want to hear about from certain comics, I think. And there's some kind of like observational comedians who are like everyman. If they bring up something that like we all relate to, I'm instantly on board with that and I want to hear them talk about that. But if they then went into a really... If they then went, what about unicorns? I go, I don't want to hear you talk about this. I don't care.
Because you don't buy their connection to it. You don't believe them.
Whereas if Tony Law went, I just got off my unicorn on the way here, I'll be like, here we go. I'm listening to this for ages. It's brilliant. And it's just a different person saying it. And it's that thing of kind of trying to develop what it is about you.
Yeah.
And going, that suits me or that doesn't. And trying to kind of figure out why. Sure. With Yoko Ono, I think it's... Everyone knows about her, so everyone knows who she is. But she's a little bit, she's still a little bit quirky and a little bit like of a weird thing to bring up.
Yes,
like if you were at a dinner party, if I was at a dinner party, which would never happen. If I was at a dinner party, and I went, because you know Yoko Ono, I'd expect one person at a dinner party to look at me like, why have you brought this up?
Okay,
even though everyone knows who she is.
So it's a shared experience enough that everyone knows what you're talking about, but at the same time, it's skewed.
Yeah, same time, it's a little bit of an odd thing to bring up. Sure. And it's funny that you're bringing it up in the first place. And it's that thing of, like, I think if you can, like, pick the subjects that people want to hear you talk about,
Yeah.
That's almost half the battle, because then they're on board. I remember watching Pulp Fiction for the first time, and there's a bit when Bruce Willis has been captured in the shop. Yep. Marcellus Wallace is getting bum raped in the room, and he punches the gimp out, gets up, and he goes to, if you haven't seen Pulp Fiction, this is a massive spoiler, but and he gets up, goes out the shop, and he goes to leave.
Yeah.
And he stops in the door.
Sure.
And he looks over his shoulder. And when I saw that for the first time, when he looked over his shoulder, I was like, yes, go back in and beat them up and kill them. That would be brilliant if you did that right now. Yeah. And if at that moment in the film he went, no, and then walked away, I would have been gutted. Because they'd gone, he could do this now, yeah, and he's not going to do it.
Yeah.
And I would have been. But as it was, he turned back into the shop, and I was on board for however long they wanted to do that for.
Yeah.
And I would have watched it for ages. And yeah, like, you know, I was like, brilliant, this is going to happen. And so they'd already won me over. So for the next, you know, 10 minutes of that film, I'm really happy. And I think a lot of the time with stand-up, it's like going to them, I might go in this direction, and having everyone go, yep, on board, and then you go, right, brilliant, I can talk about Yoko Ono now for 10 minutes.
Sure.
And so it's kind of that, going like, I might go here, it's just showing them that kind of.
And having a thing. You're reading from them a sense of them wanting you to go there.
Yeah,
that governs your improvisation.
Yeah, and it's making them want you to go there, just going like, just showing them a picture of Yoko Ono. Going, might go in this direction, and hopefully they go, yep. And at the minute, what's happening at gigs is I'm kind of going, Yoko Ono, and a few people, you see people like, yep, and then they go, oh, you're not taking us where we thought you were going, because it's not there yet. So because it's not there, it's like certain things are kind of working, and it's kind of going, but it's not. At the minute, it's like if Bruce Willis stopped in the door, go, oh yeah, and then he goes in and he goes back in the room and goes, can you guys leave him alone, please? This is out of
order.
Yeah,
sure.
And then I'll be there like, oh, I wanted you to go back into the shop, but you've not delivered what I wanted to do, and now this is even more disappointing than if you just left the shop.
Sure.
So at the minute, I'm going to go in this direction, and then you can feel people go, yep, and then I go, no plan, this is not what you wanted from this.
Yeah.
So this, of course, is Sweet Little James, and it's a joy to listen back to this. We've got loads of, I mean, I'm just so grateful to him for submitting himself to this insane concept that I had at the very beginning of my career side, not a sidestep, a branch, a career branching into being not just a comic, but also a comedy adjacent thinker up of things, trifles really, but here we are. So this is from way back when. More Compendium episodes coming out. You can email me stuart@comedianscomedian.com or get in touch with me at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy or indeed ComComPod on the various socials, and let me know other people you would like to hear archivally re-released. We've got some absolute corkers from you. Let's have some from a good while ago. I asked in the Facebook group and there were some great suggestions, but some of them were from like last year, so I think we can dip right back in the archive. Keep the feed alive and awake and give me the opportunity to talk rubbish at you, whilst I also, in the background I should say, I've got some new content. I'm doing an interview later today, but I won't say who until it comes out. But I'm looking forward to that. So new stuff coming your way as well. We will get back ship shape in sort of February and onwards, but some Compendium releases for you here. I'll have to commit to that now because I've said it. Just to remind you, you can join the Insiders Club for extra content from every episode that has it. Back, of course, 10 years ago, the Insiders Club was a mere dream until someone 3 years into my podcasting career tucked a note. Was it a tenner? Was it more than a tenner? Maybe it was a tenner into my back pocket whilst I was having a wee at a public urinal at the McCunnicliffe Comedy Festival, which back then was a secret. So that kind of kick-started the beginning of the Insiders process. Of course, it would be insane now to start a podcast without, like, built into the core of it to have some means of generating cash. But I think for the first 3 years or so, it was just me doing it for fun. And what a halcyon time that was. You can join the Insiders Club, should you wish to support this venture, at comedianscomedian.com/insiders and at comedianscomedian.com, and also at the homepage of stuartgoldsmith.com, about halfway down, you can see the trailer for my new special. It's called I Need You Alive. It comes out it's produced by 800 Pound Gorilla Media, and it was such a joy to record. Larry Dean and I taped ours together in Glasgow, not exactly the same time, but kind of, I think it was me, him on the night. And his is being released soon as well, but I'm not sure what he's doing with his. I am putting mine on Moment, and you can go to the website of your choice. Let's go to stuartgoldsmith.com because it's got slightly better graphics for the ad that I knocked up myself in 15 minutes. Thank you, Wix. Not a sponsorship. And you can go there and find the link to get to find out exactly what a moment is. You know, it's the sort of thing you could describe as a worldwide digital experience. Not a live stream, but a digital premiere of a brand new special. My point is, I did this huge rollout. You may have been part of it across all the social media platforms, the mailing list, LinkedIn, everything. And the sheer volume of people who got in touch with me, bless them, bless you all, saying, I hope I'm not an idiot, but what the fuck is this? Well, it's a digital premiere of my special, right? The special is composed of bits of The Cut and Shut, which was me in Edinburgh a few years ago, sticking together bits of End Of, bits of Primer, new bits, and that turned into this show, I Need You Alive. So if you've seen me live a few times, you will recognise some of the bits. Some of the bits will take you quite by surprise. And it is a simultaneous... Right, imagine a show that's happening online. But it's pre-recorded, so it's like telly, but it only happens once and you have to be there that once, because afterwards there's a live Q&A and an after party you can get extra tickets for and stuff. And it's very exciting and pioneering. So it's a DVD, but not a DVD, that's on the internet once. But if you can't make it, then you buy a ticket and your ticket gives you access for 2 weeks. So you can do that. But it would be lovely to see you there and shift some units and make that feel like a big thing. I'm so, so proud of it. And a huge shout out. I will do an extended shout out later at some point. Plus, there are, of course, the credits at the end. So many people were so useful, but particularly because we're dealing in the medium of the visual as I roll it out. Thank you so much to fabulous New Zealand artist Jenny Stringleman, who very kindly sort of gifted the copyright of one of her incredible paintings, which she allowed me to massively expand and use as the backdrop. And it just, by God, it pops. It was such a joy. When I first saw it, I nearly fell over on the day. It was great. So I will do some social posting about that and direct you to her site. I think it's Miss J. I'll put it in the show notes. All right. So get stuck in. Go and do all that stuff, please. And let's get back to James Acaster. No post-amble at this. At the end of this, this is a ComCom Pendium episode, and next time it'll be slightly smoother blurb-wise. All right, back to Jim, and have a lovely January. I will speak to you again soon.
That's what it is a lot of the time.
Sure.
Is me taking these things really seriously and talking about them in a serious manner.
Yeah. They need to be fairly whimsical to begin with so that you can take them too seriously.
Yeah, so I can just absolutely crush the whimsy by being really serious about it and just being like, really like, I'm going to be a skywriter and, like, you know, that's a serious passion of mine and talking about it. But with that, I kind of, had to sit down and I came up with the initial joke and then tried that out. What I do a lot of the time is you kind of try and write a joke about it, like a short joke, go on stage and try it out, and if the short joke works, it green lights. Apparently, I see that as me being given the thumbs up to write 5 minutes on it instead of just...
Yeah, okay.
So I go, oh, great, I'll do as much as I can with it now.
Sure.
And then with that short joke as, like, the door, opening the door to it.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think I was talking to Phil Kay once, and he said that when he's improvising, if the audience laughs at something... He interprets that as them saying more of that, more of what you're talking about now.
Okay.
And he gets really gutted when he sees comics do short bits of material because he thinks, oh no, talk about that more.
Yes.
So it's that thing of going, getting a short joke about it, they laugh, and then seeing that as them going, we will now tolerate you talking about skywriting for a lot longer.
Sure.
And that's like,
very you. That's a very specific thing about the way you work, is you really get mountains of stuff out of any one particular topic.
As just out of pure fear of writing a second show and going, I've got to write a show in a year and I can't go back to square one for every routine and try and think of a different subject. But what I can do is write a short joke
about
something.
I've got four jokes, and then go expand all of them.
And then just go, right, I'm going to write as much as I can about this now, and hopefully that'll make up a show. This fear is what what motivates me most of the time.
Is that to what extent is that true? Given that you're so confident and measured on stage in your delivery, is there an element of it that still frightens you?
Mm,
is it an element
of,
in the performance of it, or in the fear of being able to continually generate
material over the course of your career? Are those still present for you, those fears?
Yeah, constantly. Yeah, afraid of... The first time I ever died on stage and the worst worst experiences I've ever had, and I remember going home and taking it extremely personally, and being worried that those people would remember me for the rest of their lives as the idiot who... Just like, you know, how embarrassing was that when that guy did that? And I think that stayed with me to some degree of like, I don't like going on stage and having no one laugh at me.
Of course.
It's really embarrassing and really horrible.
Yeah.
And so, like, because I want to avoid that as much as possible, I just, also, I want to, you know, I really enjoy doing well. So there's that combined with it. My whole life isn't just, I hope the worst thing doesn't happen. But, like, you know, but yeah, you're kind of like motivated by both sides of things, and you really want to. Also, you really want to, you know, create this exciting world that people want to come back and see and revisit. But like, yeah, a lot of it is that I just want to kind of write as much as possible. I don't want to run out of stuff. I get very conscious of people coming to see me again, maybe, and going, "Well, you did that last time."
Mm-hmm.
And also, I want to get better. And I feel one of the main ways to get better is to constantly write and try and improve the material and get more out of it than you did with the last lot, or do things with it that you couldn't have done with the last lot of material. And so just continually writing. Also, I need to fill the days somehow. So, like, just writing in the day gives me something to do.
Sure. Well, let's go back a couple of steps and look at how you started, and we'll look at how the way you work now is different or the same as when you started. Mm. How did you... I mean, you were in bands originally. Was that your route into performing? I know you were...
Yeah, I was in a band with my friend Graham, and that was the whole
classic
band.
Acaster to be a band with a friend called Graham, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it was called Graham. And we were an experimental jazz pop band.
Okay.
And
what were the results of the experiment?
Disappointing. We genuinely... And I feel embarrassed when I say this now, in a way, but, like, I'm not... I shouldn't be. But at the time, we genuinely wanted... our ambition was to be the one of the best bands ever. It was a genuine aim, because we didn't see the point otherwise. We're like, there's no... Why would we be in a band to just be another band? Like, there's no point. So let's try and be one of the best bands ever. And we thought we could... realistically invent a new style of music.
Okay.
So that's what we wanted to do. Now, I know right now that sounds very naive, but I was very naive. And so we worked really hard. We tried to make it, like, and then we thought it was going to be received amazingly well.
Mm-hmm.
Before our first gig, we felt like, before walking on stage, this is a historical night. And this is going to be... Everyone's going to talk about this, and it's going to be amazing. And we went out, and it's got a very lukewarm response, and then came off, and everyone was like, what was that song? It was like, oh, okay. And we carried on, and it never really picked up. We did it for, like, 5 years, and we really loved it, but, like, you know, the 7 people we performed to a night weren't really into it. And eventually, like, he was like, I just want to stop doing this. And I'd put so much into it, and so much like, oh, this is going to be... I had such lofty ideas for it that when it stopped, I was like, I don't want to form another band. I don't want to do this again. This is too... And so instead of
going... You don't want to go through the process again of having to create a new thing with someone else.
Yeah, I don't want to form this and invest so much emotionally in it.
Mm.
And, like, I guess it's like, if you come out of a really intense relationship and you love the person, you don't want to instantly fall in love again.
Sure.
You'd rather shag about for a bit, I don't know. But, like, so with me, comedy was shagging about, and it was just, it was just like, I'll just do that for a thrill.
Yeah.
Because, like, I've never, you know, so that'll be, like, if I'm going on stage and, like, trying to do that. And if it goes badly and stuff, I can always tell people when I grow up, I did stand-up once.
Yes, okay.
And then I just... instantly just really enjoyed it, and I didn't even want to do it. It wasn't really like, oh, I want to do this for a living, or this is going to be like, because when I was in a band, I was thinking about, like, you know, our 10th album and all this, and really far down the line of, here's all the things I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And with this, I had no plan. I wasn't thinking at all into the future, because I didn't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just enjoyed it, so I carried on doing it. And then I carried on doing it when I wasn't enjoying it as well, because I was bored.
Sure.
Sitting at home doing nothing. So I lived in Kettering still, and I'd get the train to London for 25 quid to die on my ass for 5 minutes, mm-hmm. and then come home again. And I didn't even... I remember being on the train on so many journeys home, just going, why am I putting myself through? I don't even like this.
Yeah.
Like, I hated all those people in that pub tonight. I just felt really, this isn't as good as the band. The band was the best band ever. And this isn't. I'm not the best comedian ever, so why am I doing this? I was in the best band ever and I fucked it up. And now I'm in this. And I was like, why are you doing it? But there's something about it. Every time I did a gig, I wanted to instantly do a gig again afterwards, even if it went really badly. And it took me 6 months to get a routine I liked. So I went to I wasn't going to go to it. I didn't know that the Edinburgh Festival was such a big deal. So important. I didn't really know anything about it. And someone I worked with at a kitchen said, I've got a Megabus ticket to Edinburgh. It's £2. Do you want to go? It was like the day before Edinburgh started.
Yeah.
And I was like, why would I want to go to Edinburgh? And they said, because it's the big... You said you had started doing comedy. It's a big comedy festival there. So I was like, oh, okay then. And I looked in the accommodation, of course, the day before, you did nothing. So I borrowed my friend's tent and went a 12-hour bus journey and then camped for 2 weeks in... the site was like a bowl and it was raining for 2 weeks constantly. So my tent instantly flooded and I was going around doing open spots. And I didn't really know anyone. Like, I think Helm and Widdicombe were my only friends. And that was it. I was sleeping on their floors for a lot of it, and then back to the tent. And like, but while I was there doing like, I just eventually got a routine I liked that I actually thought was good. And it was one of the ones where I'd never dared do it because I thought no one will get this. It's really specific to me. It's about my me being petty, and no one will get that.
Okay.
And I did it, and it worked, and it was the first one that worked, and the first one that made me start thinking, why does that work all the time?
Okay.
And everything else is so kind of like unreliable. And then started building, and then as soon as I started building on that, I was like, actually, I want to carry on doing this for a long time. But it took me 6 months to eventually go, yeah, this is...
I mean, it sounds like you brought yourself to comedy in the way you're describing it, like with no expectations, with no concept of the Edinburgh Festival, with no concept of it as a career.
Yeah.
Do you think that might have been really useful to you in your ability to go out and try and fail and actually just do it for the sake of doing it for yourself and for the sake of pleasing yourself rather than trying to fit into some imagined mold?
I think maybe at the beginning it was, because like a lot of my gigs I just improvise and just go on, and because I thought that's genuinely what stand-ups did, because I didn't know, you know, I didn't know they actually went away and wrote stuff. And especially when like my first few gigs went really well, and then I'd watch acts go up who've written stuff and not do well, and in my head I'd be really laughing going, they've written this and I just made stuff up, I'm brilliant. And I'd be really like, ha ha ha, ha.
A darker side of James Acaster.
Really, really laughing and thinking, ah, brilliant. And then I got a deserved horrific death. And then I started watching, I went doing a gig with Mike Wozniak and thinking he was brilliant and going, that is clearly written, like he's really written that, and actually I've enjoyed that a lot more than you know, I would ever enjoy watching what I'm doing now.
Sure.
And then realise I've got to start writing stuff properly. But like, yeah, I was very much learning as I was going. I didn't know anything about the early gig with Kitson was the headliner, and I said to someone, is he off for Phoenix Nights?
Yeah.
And everyone in the dressing room looked at me like I was this like, absolute idiot. So I was like, that guy's on Phoenix Nights, isn't he? And they were like, you might want to not say that to his face.
Yeah.
Awesome. It's good. It's a good TV program. But,
So in terms of the writing that you then started to do, what was your technique there? Were you carrying a notebook? Did you have some idea of how comedians write, or were you sort of navigating?
I had no idea. I had a notebook and I was writing all the time in it, but I didn't know how other comics wrote stuff. I didn't know how to write jokes. I learned everything really late on as well. Like, I don't think I learned to properly write jokes until I went on tour with Milton and then was like forced to write short jokes in front of his audience. But like,
I just know, briefly pictured him forcing you to write short jokes in front of his audience.
Yeah, literally.
Just something to break up the one liners now. Come here, James.
yeah, in character.
Yeah.
I used to just write down loads of stories, things that happened to me, and I was really strict at the beginning that everything's got to be true. And it's all got to have happened to you, because you don't want to be selling the audience short and cheating them. It's what I saw it as. Like, if you lie to them and you tell them stuff you've made up in your head, then that is that you're being dishonest.
Sure.
And they're going to get angry about that.
Your feelings on that now?
They can go fuck themselves. Because, no, well... with that now, I just go, they'd rather laugh. Like, that's, I had a routine.
Yeah.
One night, I was I basically missed my train home from Basingstoke after a gig, and I ended up having to sleep in a bush. And my phone was dead. I didn't have any money. I was in a bush, and I'd been shopping that day for a short film I'd been working on. I'd bought the actress in the film a red dress for the film. And it was a hot day. I had a T-shirt and jeans on. And at night, it was freezing, and I had nothing to wear. So I put the dress on and was sitting in a bush wearing a red dress in Basingstoke at 3 in the morning. And two people stopped outside the bush and discussed... two guys were discussing how they hadn't beaten anyone up in a while. And wouldn't it be great if they could find someone and kick the shit out of them? And I was sitting at their feet going, if they look down, it's going to be Christmas. Like, they can't hack this. And when that happened, I obviously was like, brilliant, because I'm a new comic. I'm trying to write stuff that's actually happened to me.
Yep.
That was an awful night. I told it to people at work the next day, and they were like, that's hilarious. I was like, right, I'm doing this in clubs. I'm going to do it at gigs. And I started telling it at gigs, and as soon as I said I put the red dress on, in the comedy club situation, you could see the audience go, bollocks.
Yeah, okay.
You didn't do that.
No one would do that.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, and I got really annoyed. I was like, but that's true. Like, I'm telling you the truth. I'm not a liar. I'm telling you it, and you guys aren't believing me. And then I realised, actually, they don't care if it's true or not.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of care. If they believe it's true, and they choose to buy into it,
mm-hmm.
that's great. And if they know it's not true, and they can just go along with the joke and laugh about it, that's great. But if they suspect that you're trying to sell them a truth and it's not, that's the only time they get annoyed.
Yeah.
Like, if they think you're going, this actually happened and it blatantly didn't, that's when it's... So I was like, actually, I don't need to tell them the truth all the time. Plus, I was like, I'm 23, nothing much has happened to me.
Yeah.
So I don't know why I'm trying to, like, oh, here's my amazing life, like I'm, like, 50, and, like, I've had loads of experiences. I've had very little. I'm just sitting around hoping something bad happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
And, like, I can't live like that. And, like, actually, wouldn't it be better if I learned how to use my imagination and I could write more stuff? And, like, you know, and so... That was the thing. I was like, oh, I'm not telling them the truth anymore. I'd rather they just laughed. And, like, some stuff's true and some stuff isn't. But ultimately, I just want them to, like, at least believe the world that I've created and enter into that world and go, well, this is reality now. This is the world that's apparently acceptable. And go along with that and laugh at it rather than going, like, is he telling us the truth or not?
Sure.
Although people still get annoyed if they think you're not about ridiculous things.
Did you feel like... you were influenced by people around you? Have people ever said to you, do you know what you should do? Sometimes you'll do a bit and then afterwards another comic will say to you, oh, you were really funny then when you were doing this particular thing.
Not as much. No, it's more like I'd see, like, seeing Wozniak and going, that is, I enjoy watching that more than me, and so I'd rather do something written. That's because, but I rarely have people come up to me and go, sometimes they would, and go, that bit was really funny. But a lot of the time, I'm such a sulky little bastard that if I do a bit, say I've done a whole set of stuff that, like, I've planned and is written, and then something happens in the audience and it triggers a story that's actually happened to me, and you tell that and it goes better than everything else, and then another comic comes up to you and go, that story's brilliant, I just think, fuck off, because I didn't work on that, and I just get really grumpy about it for no real good reason, because, like, it, suddenly you've changed persona, you don't want to do that. But, like, it's more... No, I found more, it's like, with Milton, it was because I was every night performing in front of his audience, and I suddenly found I couldn't do long bits that didn't have good enough payoffs.
Sure.
And so I was forced to make sure everything had a punchline that was funny enough to warrant them listening to me for that long. I didn't like to try and do one-liners, because then you become a poor version of Milton.
Sure.
And that really riles them up.
Yeah.
So I found still doing long routines was good, but I had to make sure all the punchlines were strong enough. Whereas before that, I'd been on tour with Josie, and that was really good for making me experiment a bit more, because her audience would, if they thought you were being a bit too safe,
sure,
they'd switch off. And yeah, so you go, okay, I've got to kind of show that I'm being a bit more daring. Sure. And then so the two were kind of... But it wasn't even, at no point did either Milton or Josie turn to me and go, you should do more of this.
No,
you should
sure.
do that. It's amazing how everything seems so much more important when you're starting. I remember, like, on the open mic circuit, getting your first review on Chortle seemed amazing. And now I couldn't care less. Yeah. But that's everyone, I think. I mean, that's everyone. Like, at the time, you're like, oh, he's going to write something about me. And you take it to heart so much at the beginning.
Yes, definitely.
And
yeah.
obviously, when you're starting out, if they compare you to someone, most of the time as a new act, you take it quite badly because you're like, oh no, I'm just a rip-off of this person. Mm-hmm. And then I saw quite a lot of acts when I was starting out get compared to someone and then just go so much in the opposite direction because they were like, no, I'm not like that. I'm going to be absolutely different now. I'm going to do my own thing. And then they actually lost what made them funny a lot of the time because, like, actually, you're okay to cross over a bit.
Sure. Certainly, in the first few years of you finding your feet, it's completely fine to be a little bit similar to someone else. If that, because further on down the line, you're going to be a richer version of that, and it'll diverge more.
It's just like you've just got the first little few ingredients to it, and it might happen to be, you know, deadpan or whatever, or high energy, and it seems like other comics, but you'll add more stuff to that, and it'll mask it, and it'll get bigger. Mm. And if that is how you're getting your laughs, and people are laughing at that part of you, then it does suit you.
Mm.
And it's allowed to suit you and someone else. It's fine.
Yeah.
They've just been going for 20 years. You've been going for 5 months.
Sure.
You know, so you don't have to be, you know, straight away out the gate like no one we've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's not going to happen. We're
steering into talking about persona here. And something I've always found interesting about you, the difference between you on and off stage, is that on stage I can't imagine you swearing on stage, and yet off stage there's a bit more kind of you can be meaner, you know, than your on stage persona would allow. Do you know what I mean? You
fuck off, Stu.
Yeah, there we go. Classic. Yeah. Do you see what I mean? Do you ever find? I mean, I haven't seen you do anything on stage which had a kind of an overt target. Do you know what I mean? Or something that you were angry with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, the routines that are do come from things that I'm angry about.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed for the first few years, and probably still now a lot of the time, is that people come off very bad in my routines. Other people.
Yeah, okay.
If I was writing about a thing that I liked, then it was fine and it was quite nice and like, oh, I love this thing, it's great. Anything with a person in it, mm-hmm. the person would be an idiot, and I secretly hate
okay.
them. So it always showed people in a bad light all the time. I probably still do that quite a bit. But like, there's a lot of things that come from annoyance, but I just master. Like, I got a routine about someone who cheated on his girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
And I definitely don't like that guy. Yeah. But instead of like the whole routine being me going, you shouldn't cheat on your girlfriend, I think that's disgusting, and like really getting angry about him, I chose to focus on orchards for the whole routine and like I talk about that, because it's like, I think everyone's like almost takes it as a given, I don't like that person, I am angry about it, and it's almost like I can't really, I'm not very good at confrontation normally in life anyway,
mm-hmm.
and I think it kind of bleeds into your comedy persona that if my persona is annoyed at something, it can't actually handle it head on and has to go into this other world.
Yes, okay.
Of going, oh, you wouldn't bring an apple to an orchard and talk about apples for ages, because you can't actually hack talking about how much he hates this person.
So it kind of gives it, taking it into those areas gives it an outlet, gives your natural kind of you know, anger or those kind of more negative feelings, it gives it an outlet to it.
And again, the thing is, it suits you better to be like that on stage. It suits me better to be focusing on a silly little throwaway comment that he said and getting carried away with that and seeing that as a way of bringing him down, because again, it's just because it's very easy to prove why someone who cheated on his girlfriend is a bit of a scumbag.
Sure.
And the fact that I take the longest way round to do that just makes it hopefully funnier.
Sure.
That I don't just go dealt with in like one sentence.
Yeah.
Instead it's like, well, I'm going to talk about orchards for ages, and this is my comedy persona's way of dealing with it. It's getting way too pedantic and petty about little things, even when it's quite a straightforward issue. But I mean, that routine, you know, was born out of being on a weekend away, someone doing that and me being furious about it, and me going home and being like, I hate that guy, and he'd made me feel like I was his friend, and then he acted like that night, and that was horrible, and wanting to write about it, but knowing that I couldn't go on stage and just go, here's what happened and get really angry.
Sure.
And knowing that when he said to me, you know, you wouldn't bring an apple to an orchard, that was the bit that was funny. And that was just hearing the word orchard, that suits me.
Yeah, it does, absolutely.
Orchard, that's the kind of thing I'd waffle on about. Thanks very much. There's that. I kind of try and bury the anger amongst, below things. But, that whole mariachi bit earlier, which is ridiculous, is genuinely about when I was at school and I was into Nirvana and no one else liked them, and they would just, take the mick all the time. And everyone else liked pop music, and me and my friends were into, grunge. And we'd get taken the mick out of all the time.
Okay.
And I don't think me going on stage and talking about that part of my life is very funny, but I think pretending that I was into mariachi music makes it funny.
Sure. Okay, yeah, absolutely.
So sometimes it's like you take what you were annoyed about and then you change it into...
Is that something you discovered later about that material? Did you find yourself going, oh, God, this is about the Nirvana stuff? Or did you start going, do you know what really annoyed me was that when I was...
No, that was like while I was doing it, I started just talking about the history of mariachi music, which was all made up.
Because you heard mariachi and went, that's me.
I heard that song, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da song, and thought, oh, yeah, this would be funny. But, started talking, and then kind of just started to talk about how I thought it'd be funny if I loved one song and I hated the other one, even though they're basically so similar that no one could have that strong of an emotion about them.
Yeah, sure.
And... be really unreasonable about such a small thing that no one should care about whatsoever, and I really care about it, and I'm totally pushing it on the audience,
sure,
and making them all take it seriously. And like half the amusement as well for those routines when you're doing them is to see someone in the audience who's looking at you and taking it at face value. It's hilarious. One of my favourite things is seeing someone genuinely looking at me going, I don't know why you care so much about mariachi music, mate. And not getting the fact that part of the joke is that this is stupid. I am an idiot, I'm being completely unreasonable.
Do you have any tactics? Do you have any gear changes you can do on stage if you feel too many people are going that way? Like maybe if you're not into the stuff you're doing on tour, but when you're making newer stuff, can you... I mean, that must be difficult if you're... pushing down that highway of going, it's totally reasonable for me to think this obviously stupid thing.
Yeah.
If people aren't getting it, can you change gear? Can you...
No. I should do, but what I tend to do is kind of like, I'll maybe stop and reference how they're feeling about it.
Okay.
Because with any luck, that'll make them go, oh, we're not meant to be taking him seriously.
Sure.
And then the next routine might go a bit better. And normally that way, if I say, a lot of you are looking at me and thinking, why does he care so much about mariachi music?
Hopefully that's
a puncture. And then you can see a few of them going, oh, yeah, we probably shouldn't be thinking that. But it doesn't mean they're then going to go, right, on board now. But, it at least means I'm kind of flagging up to them.
Sure.
And I don't like to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't like to take the mask off and go, it's not really like that.
No.
I'm really mean. then put the mask on and carry on doing the routine. But sometimes you go, well, this is their night out, and at the minute I'm really kind of ruining it. So maybe I'll let them all know that I'm in on the joke.
Sure.
So that they kind of maybe feel a bit more comfortable. But normally at that point I just switch to cheese grater. And we're just literally in 5 years of comedy, my only banker. One routine.
Let's talk about the decisions you made tonight, say, when you were ordering the set that you gave us, when you were making notes beforehand. What sorts of decisions do you make about when to put certain things in the set? Or when you're doing a Club 20, which material goes where and what are the decisions behind those?
Yeah, it's different for different, depending on what the room's like. Tonight, because it's a nice, comedy-savvy audience, I chose to... There you go, guys. Don't hate you as much as you thought I did. But, I just kind of... The order of this material at the minute, because it's all quite new and I'm putting it together, I'm just trying to find the links between them. And going, so I talk about Oaxaca, and then so I go, right, that's Mexican food, can link it into Mexican music. And just, so that's the only thing that's happening at the minute.
Sure.
Or you're kind of going, I'm just going to do all the new stuff and I'll link it together the best I can. And then sometimes you just go, there's no link between these, so I'll pause for a bit longer. And then I'll go...
Lean on the mic.
I want to be a skywriter.
Yeah.
And then that'll be that. But if I'm doing like a club or something on a weekend, I go, right, cheese graters in. Now I've got to think of 25 more minutes. or 15 or whatever. But you said that kind of goes, and you kind of just put the routines in that work best in that environment. Mm-hmm. You've got to put it together like that. And in a proper, like, it depends what the club's like, obviously. But if it's like a real weekend stags and hens and stuff like that, I am living on a prayer. I just go, here's the stuff that works the most, yeah, and is the most accessible. And I'll often put that, it's so stupid saying cheese grater so many times. Like, who knew my life would turn into that, going like, you know, obviously the cheese grater is a classic. But I have to put that near the beginning and then end on a routine about top and tailing. And then everything else in between. So I've got stuff about a surprise party, and that'll normally be the 20. It's kind of that stuff. It's all kind of quite, it's gag heavy, and also most people can relate to it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't, well, at the minute, I wouldn't put any of this stuff into a club set.
Okay.
Because even if I like join it tonight, for that, there's a certain, in the same way that you can show an audience subject matter and they'll go, yep, we're on board, there are certain rooms, like if it's Stags and Hens, if I go, here's mariachi music, they'll all go, no.
Yeah, and that doesn't represent whether or not that bit's got legs. It just represents that now in this room it's not.
They don't want to hear about that. And yeah, like, I don't, you know, I wouldn't go to a party and start talking to someone who I've got very little in common with.
Sure.
And just bring up my favourite band that they don't know and go, I want to talk about this because this is all about me.
That's a really good analogy.
And so you're kind of there on stage going, I know none of you want to hear about this, so I'm not going to do it just so I can go off and go, I'm an artist. And then, yeah, okay. Like, you know.
You did that for 5 years with the band.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. Fucking hell. Yeah, I did. I always think back to the band and think back to doing a gig. I mean, a gig at Working Men's Club. It's a Friday night, and there's loads of really old guys in having a pint at the end of their working week, and the football was on. Me and Graham were setting up in the corner, and the song we used to open on involved Graham getting on the drums, and I would be at the front. We used to wear these homemade outfits that my friend's mum made us. We'd have like black trousers on, a grey shirt with a black collar ripped out of a shirt and sewed into that shirt, and a yellow Velcro tie that stuck onto the t-shirt. And I had that, and the opening song to our set, I had a loop station playing a Caribbean loop, and I had a like a voodoo shaman shaker with like pine nuts on it. And I'll just start the loop unannounced and just walk, run around shaking it with no shoes on, because you couldn't operate the pedals with the shoes on. So I was missing my socks. I remember doing that gig and just starting that and shaking it, and this old man looking at me so disappointed that I just ruined his night, and thinking to myself, this is a bit selfish. Yeah. Like, this is just imposing, ruining this man's night. And so, like, you know, I try not to do that. If I'm in a club and they're there for that, I was trying to do my best. I do what they, you know, sure, stuff that I've got that they would like. And I don't like, instantly go into like, well, I'm going to do, you know, 10 minutes about bread, mm-hmm, because they don't want to hear that. And so it's that thing of like choosing it for them as much as I can. But like, you know, and the order being like, yeah, the kind of like quite simple order that everyone kind of tends to do of like, you know, strong, mm-hmm, one of your strongest bits at the beginning, one of your strongest bits at the end. And they just hope that they don't. I mean, I'm best off in the middle in a club.
Yeah.
If I open, it's too weird for them out the gate.
Okay.
I'm not
okay.
I don't think I'm a really weird comic.
No.
But like,
some slightly awkward laughter there in the room. So,
someone there went, "You are weird. Yeah. Really weird guy." But like, I don't think I am. But like, I kind of go on at the top, and it's, if there are Stags and Hens, they don't want that straight, they want something familiar. You know, I absolutely love comics who just go out and just do dirty stuff straight at the start of a club set, of a club night. So good. It just gets it with people who've never been to comedy before. It gets it out the way.
Yeah,
almost.
Okay.
Like, there you go, there's this stuff. And like, often obviously it's really funny as well. It's not like that stuff's not good, but like, I can't get away with that kind of stuff. I can't write it, so I'm not the person to do that. But it's good if someone who can do that goes out, does it, and then when I go on, they're not there going, I hope we hear about a cock soon. Because, like, they've already heard about cocks, and so they're not... Even if they're still expecting that, it means it's more of a surprise and they like you more and they're more into comedy by that point. It's like, oh, okay, this is, and they'll accept you. Whereas when I go, this is, I don't know if any promoters are listening to this, do still book me to open. But like, sometimes if we're going first in a proper, like, you know, club, mm-hmm. they can get a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Do you have particular strategies that, as someone with maybe quite a gentle act, not in terms of the punchline density, but, you know, the subject matter, do you have strategies particular to you for dealing with hecklers? Do you have any kind of, do you like to improvise when you get heckled? Do you have your own stock of, like, this is in my back pocket, this is a...
No, I've got, just kind of try and not break persona. That's the most important thing.
Okay.
As you say, off stage, I'm a bit meaner.
Sure.
And if, when they heckle, I break persona, I have messed up so many gigs for myself by going on and starting going, talking about apricots.
Yeah.
And then someone goes, boring. I go, you shut your fucking mouth, you cunt. And then that's dealt with. Then you go, see, I bought some apricots the other day, you know. Yeah. And then... I was just like, who's this guy? Like, you're not this guy. You just call that guy. Even if it goes well, if the put down goes well, it's even worse. Because, like, you do it.
You set that bar that's what they want.
Or they applaud that, and then you go back into that, and they're like, oh, hold on. And so I've completely ruined it for myself.
Mm.
And so I have to, if they heckle me, I've got to stay in persona.
Sure.
And so if they went bored, I got heckled with boring once. I feel like this is dropping in a name, but I was doing the Hammersmith Apollo, I wasn't headlining, obviously, but it'd be going all right, and there's someone literally from the back just went, bit boring.
It's devastating. It's only a bit boring as well. They've really thought about exactly how boring it is.
Yeah,
they've increments. Yeah, right.
Enough to make me so bored that I'm heckling at the Apollo. I don't even care. Anyway, a bit boring, and I just wanted to go, mate, you can go fuck yourself, I hate you. And like, but instead, I deliberately made the story I was telling more boring. And so just added in details that didn't need to be there, and just really drew and made it obvious that's what I was doing, and and that was a lot that suited me a lot better.
Sure.
And it annoys me that I can maybe do something like that one night, and then another night I just unlearn it. It's almost like I never seem to learn a lesson. I can do that night, and then the next week someone goes, a bit boring, I go, why don't you go and fuck your mum? And then just like ruin it. And it's just like, it's annoying. I'd really like to just learn. I think sometimes it's because if you're angry anyway. Although if you're angry, when I used to work at a school in the daytime, and I was getting like no sleep. I was doing school, I had to get up at 6, go to this, it's a special needs school, with like mainly, everyone was autistic apart from the one kid who I was put with who had like emotional behavioural difficulties and was really difficult to work with. And he'd call me a cunt all day and tell me to do unspeakable things to my dead relatives. Really awful kid, like horrible. And you can't give him a rise because if you do, then you completely undo any good work anyone's ever done with him. So you have to just like take it all and just building up fuck yous all day. Like just building them up. And then go to a gig in the evening and then someone goes, Ginger! You walk on stage and you just... And you know, I can't go into this.
Yeah.
If I turn to this guy now, I'm going to suddenly unleash everything on them. And that's not fair. It's going to ruin the gig. And so I would have to just completely blank those people. But which meant during those 9 months, I had quite a few gigs where a heckler would heckle, I'd ignore them and not even address it at all. And then they'd just heckle again. And it would got to the point where the audience were policing themselves and like having a go at hecklers and going, will you shut up? I thought that. And I was just having to ignore that as well. Because I was like, I'm too wound up. I can't deal with all this. And I was just like, I knew I was too angry that if I went into it, I was going to make it personal. That I actually wasn't in a good enough mood to go... Uh-huh, Ginger, huh? And I'd be all right. Yeah, sure. I was just going to go like a bit too personal with them. So, like, I had to kind of not go into it. If I'm actually genuinely in a bad mood, I try not to go into hecklers at all. Just let the gig go awfully.
I think so. That's a strategy, I think. If you let it wound the gig slightly, then people do, it's not. Because some people do labour under the misapprehension, don't they, that it helps to heckle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sometimes, I'll help you out there. You know,
and that's the worst thing, when they heckle, because they think they're helping, and then you deal with it, and everyone applauds as a way of telling that person to shut up. Because in their head, they go, I was helping. That applause confirms I was helping.
Yeah.
And I know I'm going to do it again. And then that's just the whole set. And then at the end, they come up to you and they want to be your best friend and go, me and you, pretty good? You know, not really. Yeah. Not really. I really don't like you.
So while we're on some of the less positive aspects of the comedy circuit, we've talked in the past about lots of different acts that we've seen, other acts that have inspired us, and other acts that we might find frustrating. What sorts of things do you see? Come on, let's open the box,
here,
James.
I'm not sure about where this is going, Stu.
Yeah. What sort of things do you see that frustrate you in comedy at the moment?
I think all comics have stuff that little pet hates and things that they don't like and that frustrates them and stuff. I think really the only time I'll be watching a comedian and getting frustrated is when I think what they're doing doesn't work with who they are or something like that. And you kind of even when, like, I was watching just some comedy before it came out on Netflix. I watched Aziz Ansari, so I really like him in Parks and Rec and stuff. Yeah. And I liked all of his material in the stand-up, but he was just machine gunning it at them, like selling it so much that everything was getting an applause. Everything was, and I didn't feel connected to it at all. And I thought I don't think that suits you. I'd rather hear you talk a bit slower and not attack him so much. Whereas, like, obviously there are other acts who really go at the audience and do everything 100 miles an hour, and I think it's great. So a lot of the time it's just when I just feel like the person's not being genuine or whatever, not being... Not giving us their best, and that kind of thing. I don't think this is really who you are, or whatever. But I wouldn't say I get angry at that. I'll probably get angry. Here's something that's... When comics try and appear deep, I hate it. But like, you know, if there's a bit where like they're joking around, and then at some point we'll like, and not even in an Edinburgh show, not like, you know, classic end of an Edinburgh show thing, but at some point they try and say something profound, a lot of the time that can annoy me, only because often that profound thing these days isn't. It's not like you go, oh, no, I never thought of it like that.
Yeah,
a lot of the time it is like. Yeah, we're all fully aware. It's often it's cliches or speaking. I don't think you've really. I don't think this is you. I think you're saying a generic thing about whatever relationships or love, and trying to be like really deep about it, but actually just putting together a load of things we're told as kids or it's very basic, like Sesame Street.
Because the thing is, I've always thought that racism is pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd much rather hear a comic go on stage and go, I love racism.
Yeah.
And then at least I'm like, well, I'm listening to this.
Yeah, sure.
Seeing what this guy is going to say. You know, even if I don't agree with them. With that statement, I wouldn't. But like, you know, people just going, you know, it's bad. And you're like, I know it is. And you're not the person to teach me that.
Sure.
You're a comic, and I came here to laugh primarily and not to be, patronised. Sometimes that can, if I feel that someone's trying to, you know, be quiet and go, in that moment I realised, I don't care what you realised in that moment. In this moment I realise I've come to the wrong show.
Sure.
Like, it's just like this. But like, you know, so sometimes stuff like that. But then the thing is, I say that, and I'll get really like, oh, I hate this, whatever. But then it can still be done really well.
Yeah.
So I went to see Richard Herring's show about love, and there was loads of bits in it that were exactly those kind of techniques, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it was done amazingly well, and it was really good, and it was moving, and I enjoyed that. And I think half the time, like, the difference between him or a comic who does that and I don't like it, is that with him, he's definitely written that in the same way someone like McIntyre would write an observation and go, does everyone relate to this? Am I going to properly sum up how everyone feels so that they feel connected to this and they laugh? And that's why Kitson's so good at it as well. And it's that thing of like actually approaching an emotional sad thing the same way you approach a funny thing that everyone connects with, going, you can all relate to this. Mm-hmm. You're actually connecting with this on a personal level, and so therefore you're feeling emotional about it, rather than saying a generic thing which actually they haven't thought about it. It's not a proper observation, so it doesn't work. And it's even more frustrating when you see those things get received the same way as something that's incredible.
Yes.
Like you see someone do some a really good observational funny bit of material, and then you see someone do some weak observational stuff, and then you go, that's why everyone slags off observational comedy, because they see that and think it's easy, whereas something like the man draw is really hard to write that routine. It's really difficult, and so many people slag it off and go, the man draw.
It's so easy once it exists, once it's been pointed out, it's so easy to go, well, I mean, anyone could have said that, because that's the beauty of it, because we didn't, you know, no one did before.
You manage to just hit all the targets and sum it all up. And same with the emotional stuff. It's like, the reason why I will get all, I'll say I hate it and I don't like it, because I see people do it badly and do it lazily, and I can't connect to it at all. But then when I see Richard Herring talk about his grandmother, it's just, it's incredible. And you go, that is exactly, you've used exactly the right words. They've absolutely summed that up. I'm not laughing, but you've got me on an emotional level. I'm completely connected to this. And that's brilliant. So I guess just laziness is what I don't like half the time.
We're going to have to wrap up fairly soon, and I'm sure some of you need wheeze. We've got a bit of a chance now if anyone else would like to ask any questions. I'm just going to ask that again for the sake of the recording.
I knew this question was going to happen.
James, have you specifically come up with, and I'm going to motion to you as the questioner there did, with this image, or is this just you?
It's a bit of both. When I started out, I didn't dress like this all the time. For the listener, I am dressed head to toe in M&S. I didn't always dress like this. I kind of like sometimes have jeans and t-shirts and stuff, but then sometimes I would wear. I've always since school worn slacks outside of school. I mean, I used to combine it with every now and again, I'd wear jeans as well. And when I started doing gigs, there was every gig I did when I wore slacks and a jumper, for some reason, went better. And I didn't know, and I started to notice it and go, why is that? And I started to find that often I'd walk on stage like that and they'd laugh before I got to the mic. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I kind of just realised that that suited me more. And that a lot of the time when I went on like that, they would see me and go, we know what we want to hear from this person now. Because especially when you're a young male comic, if you walk on in jeans and a t-shirt, they might expect Russell Howard straight away and want to hear anecdotes and stories and stuff like that. And if you go on and you don't do that, it can be a bit jarring. I got to adjust to it. Whereas if you go on looking like a total dork, before you said anything, they're going, we would like to hear this guy be a dork, or just talk about weird, you know, a bit more unconventional stuff or whatever. So I just found it gave them an idea of who I was before I got to the mic and started doing more gigs like it. Also, I wanted to kind of look different from the audience and not just look like I'd got out the audience onto stage. I wanted to.
It's essential to what I do that people initially mistake me for a cocky audience member.
But yeah, I kind of wanted them to be like, he's not one of us, and so therefore he won't have the same opinions as us for the whole thing. So yeah, it kind of was that. And I genuinely like dressing like this.
Do comedians brainstorm or peer review amongst themselves in order to write material?
I don't know what peer review means.
Well, thinking my audience is pretty sophisticated.
You know, you're the kind of guy who owns a flip chart. I, uh, Yeah. So it was a sit down with other comics, sometimes like friends, and just discuss, like, I've got this bit and whatnot, and try and kind of help each other with it a bit. But not loads, but every now and again, if you've got an afternoon free and you've kind of been hitting a bit of a brick wall writing by yourself, it's quite good to invite your friend over and, like, yeah, hit things back and forth. But most of the time we end up talking about gigs we've done recently, and then for the last 5 minutes go, oh, sorry, can I just beat your brain about Yoko Ono? And then, like, try and sneak in right at the last minute. But, yeah, definitely do that every now and again. And sometimes it is, yeah, really helpful. And also, if you've helped a comic with a bit, it's impossible to watch them do that bit, watch them get a laugh, and not turn to the comedian next to you and go, that was mine, I can't remember. He totally didn't know what to do with that, and I solved it.
Whoa. Yeah, this is a nice note to end on. When was the last time you absolutely died, and why?
What do you mean, absolutely dying? Do you mean just absolute silence, or do you mean, like, just didn't go well? Because, you know...
Like a death as opposed to a bad gig.
That's... Yeah, okay. So, yeah, that gets rid of a lot of options. did a gig in Leeds maybe a couple of weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, and it was... Now, see, this is going to sound like I'm blaming other things outside my control, which is not... I'd say part of it was the gig seemed so inconsequential that I decided to do the same material I did tonight, which is not yet finished. But the audience was quite sparse and had given the compere pretty much nothing when he went on and was trying to get them going. And they were digging their heels in and didn't want to go with it. And then I was on first. And then I then decided to do 20 minutes of new. I think because I felt like it would be soul-destroying to go on. And I knew whatever I did was going to get a lukewarm response anyway. And I didn't want to go on and do stuff that I knew worked to a lukewarm. So I got selfish and decided to go and do 20 minutes of stuff that I'd at least get something out of, which I would say is not professional. I think that really, if I wanted to properly do that gig well, I should have gone on and gone, here's the 20 that's going to most, you know, benefit the night and lift it a bit because you're a difficult crowd. But
also you have to get something for yourself, don't you?
I don't think you do, but I always feel like I do.
Okay.
Like I think sometimes you've got to just go, no, it's their night out. Mm-hmm. I should, and right now I've got a job to do. Mm-hmm. And I never do that. I always get this thing that just goes, no, you've got to, you know. Also, I kind of I think back to like gigs like this, say, and go, well, they liked it at that gig, so they can like it here. Yeah, and then you go on, and then, you know, I mean, when they don't like you, going da 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 for a long time is really really quite something. So yeah. Also, I think when I properly die, a lot of the reason as well is because I will draw out routines. So if they don't want to hear about something, and they don't like me anyway, when I carry on talking about it for 5 minutes, that it just annoys them. And it's just really like, I can't believe... Because also, you kind of go... It's like if you're at a party, you started talking to someone about something, they weren't interested, and you just kind of went, I'm going to carry on down this way. I don't care. I carry on talking about this. I'm not going to pick up on the signal. And the person's like, oh, God, I'm stuck with this guy. I've got to hear about this. And like, that's... When I'm having a bad gig, that's what I'm like for the whole room. It's just like, I'm just like someone who won't take a hint and is continually going, I'm going to carry on talking about mariachi music, and you're going to, even though you don't want to hear it. So a lot of the time, yeah, the deaths kind of get worse because of that. And then often, you know, provokes a heckle, and then that's irrecoverable. sometimes when they heckle and then you come back and it turns the gig around a bit, but then again, you're in that kind of dilemma where that's the best thing you've done, and so going back to the stuff they didn't like is also going to be quite bad. So yeah, I think a lot of the time, as a broad answer, a lot of the time the reason why most of my bad gigs go badly is because I don't really have a plan B to fall back on. And so if they don't like it, they're going to get the same thing for 20 minutes. And so it's not going to get... I haven't got, like, well, they're not liking this, so I'm going to pull out that completely different routine that's going to... This always turns them. I've pretty much got more of... I often find myself in my head reaching back into my arsenal and finding the same weapon that I'm already using. So it's another pea shooter. And that's it. And so, like, yeah, it kind of goes into that.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. Would you please join me in thanking Mr. James Acaster?